You want a blackboard, Barbara?
Would be helpful. Oh, great, there is one.
Good. What I want to talk about this morning is a little bit about virus, to show you how it causes disease and how virus reproduces itself, and then talk a little bit about cancer and see if we can see the relationship between the two and how it might be possible for a virus to be at least one possible cause of cancer. Viruses have been known for some time. We've known of virus diseases actually hundreds of years ago, but the knowledge of virus and the nature of it has been really quite recent. Virus had not been observed until the advent of the electron microscope, which was actually in the late 1940s, 1950s. So before this time, virus was just a mysterious thing that was known to cause disease. One of the first experiments that was carried out with viruses in 1891 by a Russian. What he did was to have the disease, the virus disease he's working with is called tobacco mosaic disease. And it causes a mottling of the leaves of the tobacco plant. And it's caused by a virus. He knew that if the disease were bacterial, and they were familiar with bacteria at that time and had even observed them under the microscope, he knew that if the disease is a bacterial one, that it is possible to take the sap that would contain the bacteria, you could put it through a filter, and the filter would hold the bacteria. In other words, the filtrate coming through the filter paper would be completely free of bacteria and would not cause disease. And actually, this is one way of sterilizing things, is to put the liquid through a filter, and it will remove the bacteria. So what he did then was to take the sap from this infected plant and to put it through filter. And then he took the liquid that came out through the filter, in other words, the filtrate, and then injected it into another plant. And lo and behold, the plant still got the disease, meaning that the sap still contained this unknown disease element. And virus, incidentally, did not have a name at that time. So he gave it the name virus, which means noxious liquid, some strange, mysterious, harmful liquid that will cause disease, and it will pass straight through a filter. So the term virus then developed in the 20s and 30s, really, and in the 40s, the term filterable virus was recently used. And at that time, it was some mysterious element that was in liquid and that could pass right through filters, and everything was this thing that caused disease. We had no idea what it was. Then the advent of the electron microscope, we actually observed a virus, and now really since 1950, 1960, a lot has been done. We know behavior of virus and a good deal about them. Viruses differ. Just as plants and animals do, there are many different kinds of virus. They look different. Most of them have the same basic content. In other words, they have an outside coat that's composed of protein. And it might look something like this with a little tail, or it could be more or less shaped like a rod, or it could be almost spherical. A variety of shapes would be possible. This outer coat then is protein. In most cases, this outer coat is composed of many little units here, making it a rather complex structure. Inside this protein coat is a substance called DNA, or in some viruses, you may have RNA. The lecture on Monday, I mentioned the significance of DNA. This is the hereditary material of the cell. And DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. This is the molecule of life, in a way. It's the molecule that enables reproduction and carries on it all the information necessary for reproduction of the new individual. So DNA is in the virus particle, or RNA. RNA is a very similar molecule to DNA. There's a few slight differences. The sugar is different, and hence the C changes to R, but it is very slightly different. And it has one different base that's very similar, but then slightly different, and it has only one strand instead of two. RNA, in normal cells, I'm not calling a virus now cell, but in cells like bacteria and in all other organisms, we find both DNA and RNA present. DNA is the hereditary material. In other words, it has all the information on it. And it patterns, it is DNA that stamps out the RNA. Then the RNA goes out and more or less does the work. So DNA is the mastermind, and RNA goes out and patterns work. So in normal living things, you have both DNA and RNA. But in virus, you have only one or the other that functions and does the whole thing itself. So from now on, I'm just going to use the term DNA just for simplification, but remember that it could be either, and if you read somewhere about RNA, you will know that it could be either, but just for simplification, we'll say DNA, because RNA will function the same way if it happens to be that. Alright, this is all there is to the virus. Very simple. Now take living organisms, for example. They're composed of cells, and each cell has a nucleus. And inside this would be your DNA and RNA. And you would have this outer material that happens to be called cytoplasm, but it's a sort of viscous kind of material. And it's composed of protein, carbohydrates, and fats, and a whole bunch of different complex molecules. So in comparing now virus with the cell, the living cell, we find that virus and also just these two things. Living cells have both DNA and RNA, have proteins, but they also have carbohydrates and fats, a whole bunch of other things. So the cell is much, much more complex. In reproduction, the cell, when it duplicates itself, uses this, starts with one daughter cell, first doubles the DNA, then this divides, and everything separates into two cells, and then you get a cell wall or cell membrane forming between the two cells. And so you have two daughter cells. Virus reproduces in an entirely different way, and virus is not capable of carrying on metabolism. In other words, virus doesn't respire or give off carbon dioxide or take in oxygen. Virus cannot of itself synthesize all the products it needs for reproduction. Virus, in order to reproduce, must be inside a living cell. It cannot reproduce or really do anything outside a living cell. Whether virus is living or not is debatable. Depends on what one's definition of life is. Back in the 1800s, it was very easy. Life was defined as being cellular. If it had a cell, it was living. And if it didn't, it wasn't. It was composed of cells, it was living. Very simple. But now it's not so easy. Because virus does have its DNA, we wonder, is it living tendency? And so maybe we'll change our definition of life as to being composed of or containing DNA in a functional manner or some other thing, or capable of reproducing. But anyhow, at present, whether a virus is living or not, it's sort of a transition kind of thing. It probably is debatable, depending upon one's definition of life. All right, let's talk about what virus does, how it does reproduce, and how it can be effective in causing disease. Let me show what happens to a virus that attacks a bacteria. We have done most of our work with virus, with the virus that attacks bacteria. Why? Because bacteria are very easily grown. You can get them in mass numbers. And as I said before, to grow virus, you have to have them growing in living organism and living cell. And so what would be easier than bacterial cells? It's a little less easy, you see, to carve off a little human tissue and grow the virus on human tissue. And we also use chick embryos and otherwise. But it's just much easier to use bacteria. So the first virus that attack bacteria were discovered in the following way. Normally, you can grow bacteria in a test tube in a
brew something like beef bouillon. You can actually do it in your own kitchen if you want to sometime. You don't need a test tube. You just need any kind of beef bouillon. And instead of sterilizing it and then injecting the kind of bacteria you want, you can just leave it exposed to the air, and the bacteria will land there, you see, from the air. And in the course of a day, it'll begin to smell sort of funny. And that's the growth of the bacteria. And if you look at it, hold it up to the light, it'll become quite cloudy. And this shows you that the bacteria are reproducing there. And they're probably something like several million growing in a very short period of time. And, or you can do the same thing with milk. Instantly, there are bacteria in milk anyway. And in the you leave it out on the shelf for a day at room temperature, and you know that it will begin to turn sour. This is evidence, again, of bacterial activity. So what they did was to grow bacteria in a test tube, but they found that occasionally that it would appear as though the bacteria were growing, and all of a sudden the whole solution would clear, meaning there were no bacteria left. And it seemed that the term phage was used, eater of bacteria. Somebody was eating up the bacteria. Another experiment, you can also grow bacteria in a petri dish like this. And if you smear the bacteria over the top, you get a smooth, even growth in the course of one day. And, you know, it just covers the surface of your dish. But if you drop some sewage, some raw sewage on there, very frequently, in that area, no bacteria will grow. Something is inhibiting the growth or eating them. Well, this was later discovered to be virus. And this is how virus can attack bacteria. Well, okay, what do viruses do when they attack the cell? They may, and the same thing could happen if they're attacking your cells too. In other words, if you have a virus disease. And this is what happens when the virus attacks a cell in a regular virulent infection. In other words, you really have the stuff, whatever it is. Okay, here's the cell. Happens to be a bacterial cell in this case. And the virus is embarrassing. About that size, just so you have a picture of the bacterial cell versus the virus. Now you see why we've never seen a virus before. Bacteria you can barely see under the microscope, even highest power, you know, it just looks like a squiggle or a scratch in the, you know, or, you know, these little scent marks in front of your eyes. Just barely visible. And if the virus were that size, you'd never see it. Well, I'll make it bigger so you can see it. Okay, what's it do? The virus sits on the outside. Oh, it has the little structures here, and it has sort of like a drill mechanism. And what it does is to shoot the DNA right into the cell. Protein coat just stays on the outside and falls off. It's the end of it. So the only change that takes place when you have a virus infection is that the DNA of the virus is being shot into your cell. What does this mean? Well, if the infection is virulent, it means the following. This happens to be the chromosome of the bacteria. This information is so potent when it enters, it has genes on that say, okay, stop all work for bacteria. That's thing number one. Says now, use all the stuff you have there, all the, it's like somebody coming into a, maybe you're making supper, you know. Somebody comes into your kitchen and says, okay, no more supper for you. You're going to work for me now. I want you to, all this food now has to be going for what I want. And what happens then, it says, reproduce just virus DNA. So all of this protein, carbon, carbohydrate, and all of the food materials and everything in this cell then goes to work to produce new virus DNA, and protein coats just around it. In the course of some 20 or 30 minutes, what do you have? You've got 200 or 300 of these little virus sitting inside the cell. And they used up all the material that was in the cell. And when that's used up, then that's it. What happens? There you have these 200 virus, and there's nothing else left. The cell just sort of breaks open, and out they spill. Ooh. Now that's pretty good for reproduction. Bacteria we thought was good. That bacteria can double in 20 minutes. That doesn't seem too bad. But if you've got 4,000 bacteria, and if in 20 minutes that doubles, you've got 8,000. In another 20 minutes, you've got 16,000. And, you know, after a while, it begins to be a sizable number. But the virus are even more effective. In 20 minutes, you may have 200 of them, all capable of infecting another cell. And there they are. So this is a virulent infection. And you see, a virus infection probably hits you a little faster than bacterial infection. You may be aware of this. But, you know, it really can bang, it hits, and there it is. Well, how do you get rid of it? That's the next question. If you have a bacterial infection, what do? You can get an antibiotic for it. Antibiotics are substances produced by living organisms that prevent growth of bacteria, actually, and also certain fungi. Incidentally, antibiotics are useless for viruses. Will do you no good to take an antibiotic for a virus infection. And it may be harmful in the respect that it may cause bacteria to become resistant to whatever you're taking and transfer that resistance to maybe harmful bacteria. You have a lot of bacteria in your intestinal tract. And if you guzzle down a whole lot of antibiotics, the only bacteria left in your intestinal tract have got to be resistant to it, else they would long since be killed. And then maybe you go to Mexico or something, you haven't been up on your typhoid shot, or, you know, you just swallow typhoid bacteria. And that one, that bacteria would probably be sensitive to most antibiotics. But if you've been guzzling antibiotics down like mad, then your the bacteria in your intestinal tract, you see a resistance to it. They can transfer their resistance to that typhoid organism that you swallow. And this is known for fact. So it's not wise to use antibiotics when they're not necessary. It promotes resistance, and therefore you could see that these antibiotics could be useless. So this is why they're not sold on the open market. You know as well as I do, if they were sold in the open market, everyone, their cousin, would be taking them for every headache, sore throat, or imagined illness, and they would become like sugar pills are completely valuable. So we have to monitor the use of antibiotics and give them only when there is a bacterial infection. Right, well, that still didn't answer the question, what do you do about virus? Well, you don't take an antibiotic, that isn't. Fortunately, the body does produce a substance that combats the virus infection. Otherwise, I guess we'd all long since been dead. This substance is called interferon. And it's produced by the cells and apparently stops the further growth, reproduction of a virus. Well, wouldn't it be nice now if the minute you feel a cold coming on, you can hop to the doctor and get a shot for interferon. This was hoped for at the time it was discovered, but it doesn't appear as though it can be produced in sufficient quantity to make this feasible. And there's always the danger of injecting this substance, you know, protein in that you might have an immunological reaction, you know, like a penicillin reaction or something. It could be dangerous. So, incidentally, we'd have to produce the interferon from human cells and living cells. So, the source doesn't seem that it could be sufficient. Could use monkey cells, but they're really not much more abundant than human cells. The line of approach now is trying injecting people with various substances that will cause their cells to produce more interferon. So this seems to be the present final approach, and you may hear more about this in the future. But this is basically what we do for virus infections. You probably also heard of vaccinations for virus diseases. We can also, if you have certain virus diseases, you build up after you've had the disease. Of course, this takes about 2 weeks. So after you've had the disease, your body builds up what we call antibodies. These are those things that combat the real thing when it should attack. Well, after you've had the disease, for example, measles, your body has antibodies against it, and theoretically you won't get it again. But, you see, that takes 2 weeks, and you can't. The only other possibility now would be to build up antibodies without having the disease. And here is the principle of vaccination. You introduce just a little bit of the substance, not enough to make you really sick, but enough for your body to build up the antibodies. And then you see your safe against disease. So we have this for measles now and polio. And, you know, all these particular vaccines. Common cold is virus disease. Wouldn't it be nice then if we went to the doctors and got a vaccination and that would be the end of the common cold? Sounds great, doesn't it? Or influenza, the same kind of thing. A group in England were working on this very thing a few years back. Sounded great, you know. They had trouble culturing the virus cells, however, the common cold virus. They first would have it and then they wouldn't. Normally, you can tell if you're growing virus by the behavior of the cells. They look abnormal. You can compare them with healthy cells, and they look different. You can tell the virus is growing. And they grow this in the hospital labs if they're testing for rabies or some other virus diseases. In other words, they send in a dog or an animal that has bitten somebody and want to test for rabies. They will, this again is a virus disease, they'll grow it and to see if the virus is present and growing in the cells, and they'll look abnormal. The tissue they use human tissue, didn't look any different though. They could barely tell whether they had the virus growing or not. Obviously it wasn't growing too well. But their only way of telling, they found, was to inject the cells and this tissue which they were growing the virus into a healthy individual. That individual got the cold, well, I guess it's not growing okay. And if they didn't, they simply didn't. Rather interesting, they found that exposure to cold, wet feet, all that sort of stuff that you hear, or if you should call, they no effect on whether the victims got a cold or not. The important criteria was whether they were injected with a virus or not. If they were injected with a cold virus, they invariably got the cold. If they weren't, they didn't. And it didn't matter whether the feet were wet or dry at the time of injection or afterwards or otherwise. It was irrelevant. You often hear people say that, gee, I was sitting in a car and that guy in the front seat wouldn't shut the window and I had a draft on my neck all the time and I got a cold, you know. Well, I'm sure you've heard of something like that. Somebody got wet feet and therefore they got a cold. Well, now think back of all the times you sat in the breeze and you didn't get a cold. You perhaps in the middle of summer you drive with the window open all the time and wonder maybe why people don't open the window so you can get some fresh air. You never complain about getting a cold then. It's once or twice, you know, some guy left the window open. You've got air on your neck and you got a cold. Well, our suggestion is that probably you had the cold or was coming down with it at the time. The window was open and that's why the wind bothered you and annoyed you and made you feel like you were getting cold. You probably had it all the time. You know, you feel your skin is extra sensitive before you come down with a cold, and anything like this is going to affect you, and the wind will feel, gee, I should shut that window on, I'm going to get a cold, and invariably you do, because you're really coming down with it at the time. And just think of a thousand times you've sat in a breeze and never gotten a cold. So anyhow, back to the growing the cold virus.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yes.
I don't understand that, because, you know, like, I've been in athletics a long time, and if I build up a good sweat and then I just sit around and catch a chill, I invariably
you've got two factors involved here though. You're overextending yourself, you're getting very tired and exhausted, and then you're sitting around, and then you've got, because to get a cold, of course, you've got to have exposure to the virus, for one. But then your physical condition at the time is going to be very effective in whether you will contract this or not. Because we're exposed to cold virus all the time. And whether we get the cold or not would be determined first by whether you're extremely tired. If you're very tired, you can pick up a cold quicker than anything. Or if your nutrition is, this would probably not be a factor, but kids in college, you know, stop, don't bother to eat or otherwise, and then they stay up all night and they come down with one cold after another or worse. They cannot ward them off. And so if the body in a state that it can ward off this particular cold, then I think this is, and being chilled, you see, you're putting a lot of energy in just trying to keep warm, and then it doesn't have that extra energy to ward off the virus itself. But a cold of, what I'm trying to say is just a breeze in itself is not going to give it to you. You have to have the exposure to the virus. But then consider also, is your body able to combat it or not at the particular time? What's the state of your body condition? Concerning the possibility of developing a vaccine for the common cold, they had no success whatsoever. Came out with two possible conclusions. One was they weren't sure that you even developed antibodies against the cold that you have, meaning that if your blood doesn't build up antibodies, there'd be no hope for vaccine. Secondly, they discovered that there is not one strain of the common cold, but many, perhaps 50 or more, or maybe even 100, they did not know. But again, imagine 100 vaccinations and then dubious value. So this was their conclusion, and probably you will not see a vaccine for the common cold. Incidentally, they discovered later on how to grow their virus more effectively. Apparently, it would not grow at body temperature 98.6. It required slightly cooler temperature around 92 or 3, implying your cold virus is in the nasal membrane here where cooler air is coming in all the time. Apparently, it is slightly lower than body temperature than say number growth here. Okay, this is the virulent infection now with viruses. Another way that virus can attack a cell, and this is the kind of attack that relates to cancer. We call this a temperate kind of infection, or resting, maybe you like that term better. In this case, it starts out the very same way. There's your virus and injects DNA into the cell. But for some reason or other, this DNA, maybe it's defective, for some reason, it does not do the same thing to the cell that the virulent did. It apparently is not capable of causing the bacteria to completely work for the virus, and instead it just attaches to the chromosome of the bacteria. And whatever genes it happens to have on it will just be added to the bacterial genes. By looking at it, you could never tell it had this kind of virus in it. We call it a temperate virus. You would never know that it was in there because it's attached to the chromosome. You don't see any free virus floating around. Does it affect the cell? Yes, in some cases it does visibly affect it. Other cases it may not make any visible effect that you could tell. But in the case of the bacteria that causes diphtheria, the bacteria is normally harmless. It does not give you diphtheria. But if inside that bacteria is a certain kind of virus attached to the chromosome, this virus apparently causes the production of an extra toxin or poison that gives you diphtheria. Same thing incidentally happens to be true of scarlet fever. The bacteria that causes scarlet fever is Streptococcus. You probably all had a strep throat at one time or another, but maybe not all of you had scarlet fever. You've just been lucky. The strep bacteria that attacked you did not have the right kind of virus inside it, or a virus inside it. It might have again produced an extra toxin. So in some cases, now in all cases it does not visibly affect the cell, but in some cases it does. All right, enough for virus now. Let me go over to cancer. Talk about cancer, and then see if we can see relation between the two. Cancer is a condition in which first the cells do not mature like they're normally supposed to. In other words, your blood cells, for example, wouldn't mature into the functioning white cells, or otherwise they would remain immature. Or if the wherever the cancer was, we have found that these cells don't develop and perform their correct function, and secondly, they continue to divide. They act like useful cells, continue to divide. Meaning then, that the behavior is almost like a bacterial in a very nice broth, because you've got first one cancer cell, it divides into two, and these are remain as two useful cells, and each of these divides into four, and then you've got four cancer cells. And then these each divide, and you've got eight cancer cells. None of these are carrying on their correct function, they're just dividing. Then you've got 16, and then you've got 32. Depending on how quickly they divide, they may divide once a month. So, for probably 2 years, you never know you have the cancer, maybe 3 years. But then, after you've got maybe a million of those cells, next month you've got 2 million, and the next month 4 million, and then all of a sudden you begin to realize you've got the cancer, and then, you know, it goes down quickly. But by the time you discover it, all these cells are dividing and it doubles you. So, the other thing about a cancer, the difference between a malignant cancer and a benign tumor or growth, is that the cancer tends to break up. It will spread through the body. Whereas a benign tumor tends to be encapsulated in this nice little thing, and it will not spread through the body. But the malignant cancer will break up and will spread through the body. So what can you do about it? If you can operate and remove all the cancer, fine, that's the most effective thing you can do. But the thing is to get it early enough before it begins to spread through the body. If you're too late and it begins to spread, you see, then how are you going to know where to get those single cells that's here and there and throughout your body? What they usually do would be to operate where it is, take out much more tissue than necessary, hoping you see to get all of the cancer. Then perhaps the lymph nodes too, in the hope that if it has traveled, that it will have, you have lymph nodes that tend to collect extraneous debris and extraneous cells, and hopefully that your lymph nodes, adjacent lymph nodes, have, you know, gotten all these stray cells, and none have gotten to the rest of the body. But it's just a matter of, well, chance, hope, and waiting, you see, for about 2 or 3 years. And if nothing shows up in 2 or 3 years, you're probably okay. But if it does, you see. Because it will take probably about that long, or maybe you have 5 cells that dislodged from the liver someplace. It would take about perhaps that long for these to, depending again about on the rate of division, how long it would take. But these are essentially the characteristics of the cancer, that it will continue to divide. Cancer cells will continue to divide. Something is wrong, that this regulatory mechanism is off, and that it doesn't, they don't mature. We find that if DNA reproduces inside the cell must divide. So really, all you have to do to produce a cancer cell would be to inject a gene into that cell that said reproduce DNA. And what kind of a gene might that be? Seems like it could be a virus, doesn't it? Because what does virus do when it enters the cell? It says reproduce DNA. It happens to be virus DNA. But if the virus is attached to the host DNA, then it would reproduce host DNA, and then the cell has to divide. Maybe it's just one gene that just is injected into that cell somehow, and a cell has to divide. So this is a potential. What kind of a virus? Then you see there could be a relationship between virus and cancer. If a temperate kind of virus enters the cell attached to the chromosome, then if it had a gene that said reproduce DNA, DNA was reproduced, then that cell would have to divide. And the offspring would also have that little hook of virus on it. So the offspring would be the same as the one cell. And so then you've got 1, 2, 4, 8, 16.
This little virus comes on.
So here's the cell, and here's the virus stuck on there.
Isn't it on the outside?
It's right on the chromosome. Oh, if it is a temperate virus that has injected the DNA, the virus first attacks from the outside.
Okay.
If it is effective in infecting a cell, it will inject the DNA inside.
Okay.
What happens then is either it may cause a disease like measles, in other words, you may get the measles infection, and then, or you may not get any visible sign of infection. The virus instead attaches to the chromosome of the cell.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on, all cells that are divided from this will have that virus on it.
Okay.
You mentioned about having bacteria, for instance, in the kitchen, in the open air like this.
Uh-huh.
So you might say they are exposed to these bacteria.
Oh, fantastic.
Really on a constant basis, isn't it?
Yes, incredible how many bacteria you could just collect from the air, from water. Incidentally, even distilled water grow bacteria. We've been discovering in hospitals that there's a problem with these vapor things, you know, and it says supposedly sterile the water. Well, it isn't sterile. We've discovered the bacteria in it, and they really multiply in these distilled water vapor things, so, and have caused disease there. So So it's incredible where they are.
Would I be correct in saying the condition of the body then is more subject then to whether it will take on and have these bacteria affect them? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, in most cases, right. Because, let's face it, you can't avoid them. And so your bodily resistance is perhaps one of the most significant factors in whether you get a cold or whether you get one thing or another. You're probably, this is very true with pneumonia too. Many of us harbor the pneumonia bacillus right inside our mouth, or coccus, I should say. Many of us carry it all the time. And if you get in a very reduced condition, you could get pneumonia. There's others that we don't carry, but the general idea is that if your body resistance is down, then you are more susceptible to these things.
Is the term germ just sort of a layman's term for bacteria?
Yes, generally. One exception to this, typhoid you're not normally exposed to, and we're not unless you've been injected with typhoid. You're not normally resistant to that. There's some that we are not exposed to, and therefore we don't have resistance against. And typhoid and cholera, dysentery, these we don't have floating around, and if we did, you would pick them up.
Resistant antibiotic resistant E. coli transplant resistance.
Yes.
To a typhoid. How's that done? Can you explain that?
It's a kind of sexual reproduction. Only it's done between the bacteria that causes typhoid is a different genus from the one that is present in the intestinal tract. And apparently, it's this kind of a thing that happens. They normally in sexual reproduction, a tube is produced between the two cells, and also in this instance, a tube is produced. And this resistance factor is just a small bit of DNA, which then transfers from one into the other.
From one species to another.
Right.
True.
But if you study bacteriology, you'll know that the anterior bacteria, which would be the ones that you normally have, which would be E. coli, plus Salmonella causing typhoid and those causing dysentery are all very closely related, and this probably helps with that.
Some different nutrient qualities and so on, but actually between these different species,
One hears that phrase that
is,
you have a hereditary tendency to something. Is there anything to that?
Yes, definitely there could be. In other words, your cells could be more susceptible to taking on, or you would be, this would be particularly true, I think, of diabetes. You would have be more likely to develop it. And I think then what you eat and how you, if you are one who might be liable to get it. And
you think that's true of cancer too?
Could very well be. We don't know. In other words, could very likely be. There are a lot of things about cancer we don't know. Incidentally, viruses probably could be a possible cause of cancer, but it's not the only cause. We know this. There are many causes of cancer. I think cancer is a condition when you alter the information within the cell somehow that it behaves and continues in the manner that it does. In other words, you somehow maybe turn off a couple of genes and turn on, or by a couple of little mutations or hereditary changes, you alter that cell hereditarily. How can you do it? It could be done by a virus bringing in the right kind of information. Could also be done by drugs that cause a mutation, or a carcinogenic substances, for example, cigarette tars and this kind of thing. Could be caused by X radiation, which I might mention later on.
Well, to get you onto maybe a particular, but it would be of interest, I think, to others with all the traveling going on, the tourista. And everybody's had their ideas of what causes this, whether it's an amoeba, this, that, or so on. I was reading recently where they thought it was a variant strain of E. coli. Do you have any further information on that? And any information?
The cause what?
Tourista, the usual travel diarrhea. That it has to do with variant strains of E. coli. Do you have any information on the genetics of that and the pathology?
No, I don't. But if it were, in other words, implying that you're taking these up by the water you drink or otherwise, is that the situation?
Nobody ever knew what it was. They're just trying to center in on it. it isn't an amoeboid thing, and it isn't this, and it isn't that, but somebody recently came up with this idea of variant E. coli strains. I was wondering if you had any
E. coli is known that it can cause disease in certain cases and under certain conditions, and it wouldn't be possible. But I would be less likely to consider this, because for you to take up E. coli, it would mean that whatever you are eating or touching would have fecal contamination. But this is very possible this summer.
It could be a viral associate or something as such.
Yeah, I see.
With these other diseases, I didn't hear in the particulars of it. I don't know if it's been worked out yet, but this is the first.
Could be possible, because in these, or an intestinal thing that spreads around readily, it would be very easy for it to spread. Because this summer, we just made some tests looking for E. coli, the presence of E. coli, which one normally considers as harmless. And testing a variety of things, we found E. coli in, the scoop where you dish out ice cream. We found it in the water there. We found it also, probably one of the worst places would be, in the bathroom, on the doorknob as you walk the door.
What is E. coli?
It's the organism that's present in your intestinal tract. And you would discharge billions of them in a fecal. Would be present by the billions. And usually in testing the water, quality of water, we test for E. coli rather than looking for typhoid bacillus or otherwise. Because if you look for the typhoid organism, then, you'd have to wait till somebody had typhoid germs before you'd even know you had any real potential danger in the water. So we look for E. coli, which is excreted in the by the billions, and if you find it in the water, then immediately they go to work and find out what the source is and do something. So this is what you look for rather than typhoid or cholera or dysentery, hoping to get it before someone with typhoid, you see. Before you have an epidemic on your hands.
Is someone taking this, like, in Holy Village?
Pardon?
Someone taking for this in Holy Village?
No, I was in Arizona. We were working in bacteriology in Arizona. And we were, but it could be anywhere, you see. No, particularly, some of my students worked in the gas station, the restrooms there, and gee, what you can pick up in these gas station restaurants. That's sort of fun. And in the restaurants around town is also sort of fun, too. Wash thoroughly if you're going to go in some of these not so hot places, and wash your hands thoroughly before eating or sticking things in the mouth. And
yeah, but I mean, like, the cold water and no soap in my mouth.
Yeah, right.
Then you have to get the door open again.
That's the problem, isn't it? Use a paper towel. Use a paper towel and then dispose of it, you see, before you get in the car, one of those receptacles there, to get out of the bathroom. But, no, there are a lot of these things that's difficult to avoid. But, really, I think most of your trouble comes when you're traveling in the South. At least I've had this problem, if you go across the border into Mexico or someplace. If I went into Mexico, I think I'd bring my own water. I've heard of so much that you can pick up in Mexico and elsewhere, but I'd be tempted to bring my own water and sort of maybe even bring my own food. I don't know. But, very few people seem to come in and out of Mexico without having some sort of disorder. But I think throughout the most of the rest of the U.S. is going to be that. Except, I mentioned one time I was talking about bacteria and disease in the South. I think they're resistant to some of these things that we're not. And you come in, for example, we're in North Carolina one summer, and really hot there, It seemed like about 100, but I guess it's only 90. But that's a good incubating temperature, incidentally, 90. And somebody, I never knew when or who or what, would bring in sandwiches, and they'd sit on that shelf all day at 90 degrees. I don't know when they're brought in, but there they sat. There was no date on them. They could have been there a week for all I knew. And the ingredients in those sandwiches, incredible. They'd have tuna fish and mayonnaise, ham and mayonnaise, and how anyone could eat those without getting a salmonella food poisoning is a mystery to me. And yet, I guess some people bought them, and there they sat. And you had no way of knowing when they came in. They were not refrigerated, and, well.
Well, don't you think it's sort of a mistake to be too antiseptic? Because then if you go anyplace, you don't have anything built up.
Yeah, this is this problem, because if we grow animals in germ-free environments, then, wow.
Right.
You let them out. So, in other words, don't be too fastidious at home with your kids.
That's
let
what
them
I mean, yeah.
Play around and, you know, nothing like good, healthy dirt. That's a lot less harmful, you know, than some other things. But I guess reach a happy medium and exercise caution when you do go places and see, you know, that sandwiches have been sitting out at room temperature for a while.
And certain regions have, you build up an immunity when you live in a certain region.
I think so, right? I don't think those sandwiches probably would have bothered those people. They're used to them, you see. But maybe us coming from elsewhere, because a lot of the people did get sick from eating the food. They weren't resistant to that.
I mean, you should sit sandwiches around your own home, so no matter where you go, you're in business.
Now, that would help, because you have your germs at home, and they have their germs. And the point is, that if you let their germs, the room temperature, the germs will multiply. So maybe one of their germs won't hurt you. But 500 of them will, that have multiplied at room temperature in a few hours.
Okay.
what's this crunch thing that's going around?
My guess is it's a virus. And very quickly contacted and very difficult to probably completely wipe out. It would require very extreme. Pardon? Yeah. I mean, you would have to be strict that no one touched food except the few people that are working in the kitchen, and they should thoroughly wash hands, perhaps sterilize even, you know, before touching anything, before you could, you know, completely wipe out something like that. But you've got so many different people, and children might stick a finger on the food, you know, and you weren't looking, and, you know, and...
Well, a 24-hour virus, how does it automatically, does the body just shut it down after it's killed so many...
Some people apparently carry into this, though. In other words, the symptoms are gone, but they may still have it. So I've heard, and you might know whether you're a carrier, come down with it sort of like once a month, same thing, you know, whenever you're in a weakened condition. That's the case. Apparently, I've heard, no, whether it's true or not, that take milk magnesia for 2 or 3 days in a row and really clean yourself out, and hopefully it doesn't seem too palatable when you have it, you know, but anyhow, normally, you know, the interferon will come too, and it'll be 24 hours. One thing nice about it, though, is it only lasts 24 hours, and then you know you're going to be better, instead of some of these other things, you know, might go on for a long time. Or if you're one of these lucky women that gets morning sickness, that goes on for several months. But one thing nice, you know, it's just 24 hours, and if you're a little overweight, it'll take care of a few extra pounds. And otherwise, a nice rest in bed. And
I was curious, so I went into great detail telling how you things you cannot use to ward off flu. And since, especially with families, I think probably these are the most...
But in other words, if someone in your family gets the flu, what can we do so that the rest of the family doesn't get it?
Well,
is that what you're saying? Or
that
no one in the family gets it?
But okay, what about that same person?
Pardon?
You know, what about that particular person? Because you mentioned don't use antibiotics, don't use...
Oh, if you do have the flu.
Okay, yeah.
Get good bed rest. In other words, one of the dangers would be that it would go into a bacterial infection. So take care of yourself when you have it, that you don't get a bacterial infection and get pneumonia or something like this. But if you do, the minute it does turn into a bacterial infection, then get your antibiotics right away.
What are some bacteria?
What are some?
Yeah.
Pneumonia, for one, is ear infections are most likely bacterial. You can tell it's bacterial. Bronchitis is bacterial. If you cough up a puff or this kind of thing, or if you have this yellow thick mucus coming from your nose, you know it's bacterial, and very often you get bacterial back there, then there's danger of going into the ears, so do something about it then. The common cold would be just a clear, you know, cold.
Well, what's virus pneumonia?
This would be a pneumonia that is caused by a virus, and rather difficult to take care of, you see, because we don't have anything.
Mm.
Then, bed rest and take care of yourself.
And you does that last longer? Or?
Can, yeah. Often not as potent, often not as virulent, but it can last longer, and, you know, it can really be a bad thing. So take care of yourself if you have it, and get rid of it.
Why is the staph infection so hard to overcome?
Because staphylococcus has already become resistant to antibiotics. This is essentially the reason. And we don't have many antibiotics that will combat it, if any, you see. It is very often resistant to the antibiotics. So you're going back in staph infection to the era of no antibiotics. And if we're not careful, this could happen in many other things, too. If we overuse antibiotics too much, we're continually looking for new antibiotics, but trying to keep them fluctuating. So first you use this, and then you use another, and you know, to keep their effectiveness. But one could see that if we continue to overuse antibiotics, we might sometime reach an era of going back to the Middle Ages or the 1920s before the era. Yes, definitely, because they have buttermilk and yogurt, both good. They contain a lot of the bacteria that are good to have in your intestinal tract, and they will resupply these.
How long does it take to restore the normal bacteria after a long course of antibiotics?
I don't know, but I guess you should probably take it for about a week or 2 weeks or so to. Yeah, this is one of the problems. If you take antibiotics for a long time, you'll wipe out your intestinal flora. Then you can get a yeast infection, which is even worse to get rid of. The yeast will take over in your intestinal tract. Normally, the bacteria will, kill it off, but that's, again, a problem.
In the last couple of years, we've had more antibiotics coming out that are hitting the resistant staph. It's been kept pretty well under control. The gram-negatives are now one of the major problems that we've found.
Yeah.
Not only here, but even in far distant foreign places, there hasn't been a lot of antibiotics introduced, it, strangely so, similar to the gram-negative problem.
And apparently it's gram-negatives that are in this so-called, quote, sterile water, and it's caused problems, too.
I don't know if this is the your field of study at all, but I've been taught a little reading on the Chinese method of healing, which using needles.
Using what?
Needles. That's one. And they claim that there's like 720 hollow points in the body, and the specialists, they know another 120. And they use this instead of medicine. And they've been using it for hundreds of years and have revived it more. Higher paid field because we were running out and getting enough medical doctors for the population.
Since Reston, the team that went over to China, Reston had his appendectomy there. This has created a real big stir along China in general with acupuncture in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And along with a lot of current interest in witchcraft and so on and so on.
That isn't the witchcraft thing though, is it? Mm-hmm. Acupuncture?
No, it's a Chinese thing. We have our things that have theirs.
Is it actually?
It's supposed to be marvelous.
Is it an actual puncture? Is it actual puncture?
Yes, superficially. They have how many hundred spots?
Well, in all, I guess it would be like 840. Because 720 is said the Edmonds doctors that work with this, they have to know that many points in the body. And then if they still were not diagnosed from there, then there's still another 120 hollow points. And they
what do you do, diagnose or cure? With
well, they claim that what I was reading is that they can tell by the pulse. You know, like with generally when you go in the doctor's office, they take one pulse. They claim that there's 10 different ways of taking a pulse. And from this pulse reading, you can tell or diagnose what is happening in the body. Now,
Yeah. And then you have a big eye problem, so they stick a little gold needle in your ankle bone and you feel great.
I would smell that we will veer this direction somewhat.
You what?
I would smell that we will veer somewhat this direction. We've become pretty sterile in our specialty approaches, and the laying on of hands is so much appreciated. Mm-hmm. And there's so much self-hypnotism to one can put oneself in the right frame of mind and just to be in good health, as you mentioned, to prevent disease. The emotional and physical mm-hmm. matters that are prophylactic and preventative medicine is a big thing now, will become more so. And this will slip into that somehow. It's a foreign thing, it's an exotic thing, and it's a not terribly valid thing, but there's a little something. It's going to sneak something unsuspected more about it, similar to our need for the laying on of hands.
Mm-hmm.
This has fascinated people, and there's a valid reason, although it's a largely invalid, in most aspects invalid, in the ways one we would tend to think of it in our scientific manner of thinking. It's invalid. But from other aspects, there's mm-hmm. something.
What fascinated me also is that they claim that the Western style of treating is treating symptoms, you know, and then they claim that it's more treat a whole body. So when you're talking about emotional and physical well-being, mm-hmm. they're talking about a whole body thing. And then when it comes in with kinds of germs or a bacteria like this, they claim in this one office they've been using the same needles. At the end of the day, they'll sterilize them, and they haven't had an infection transferred from one body to the next in 15 years. And we make such a point of this sterilizing, and I don't...
Well, I don't think they purposely stick the needle into a active infection area. And they may not even stick it in far enough to transfer it.
Mm-hmm. In our rationalist medicine, we forget some of this mm-hmm. laying on the hands and so on. And this mm-hmm. physiotherapy was quackery. But these things, it's like a minority party keeps coming up and getting revitalizing and getting absorbed. We're so rational that we need occasionally some of these exotic things that aren't terribly valid, but yet just remind us that we need to be concerned about the whole person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this That's is very it. True that, in other words, that there are a whole bunch of aspects that have to be considered in the particular disease you have, one of which is the perhaps the infective agent itself, but all the rest would be the rest of your body and the condition of it and your mm-hmm. mental, emotional outlook.
Well, we must have some need to cover people to talk, but hunger for information about this. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned it, maybe it shouldn't be spoken too much, but maybe it should in regard to tumors. Early diagnosis, early cure, is a generalization that's so in some, but each one of those little viruses is probably of a different nature or other causes that change these different types of tumors and originate from different types of cells. Each one has its own personal life history, each type of tumor, and some metastasize almost immediately. Others mm-hmm. don't, but quite characteristically, for quite a long period of time. One originated, say, in a cervix, would not tend to metastasize distantly for a long, long, long time. So early diagnosis, early cure is true.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful to promote that, but it gives a false idea in regard to many other types of malignancies mm-hmm. that quite to do so.
Yeah.
From the start, it's probably metastasized.
Mm-hmm. Some are essentially inoperable, too, and which makes another problem.
What's happening in leukemia?
This is a kind of blood cancer, and I think here they're just trying different kinds of drugs. And
I mean, what's happening to the cell? Do you know? Is it the same thing?
Yeah, here again, your cells do not mature, and so you've got, actually the central problem would be probably in your bone marrow where the cells are being reproduced, and then you've got immature white cells, and you get vast numbers of them which don't mature and carry out the right function.
Oh.
I heard something about bone grafting. Is that proven successful or not?
I don't know how successful it is. The problem with grafts is any injection of these grafts.
bovine bone. I think you're thinking of other than human bones starting to be used, bovine bone or something like that. I think it's just been prepared commercially and being sold now.
I know. I've got a brother. My wife's family had trouble with aplastic anemia, and they were thinking about bone grafting for a while. Out of that, but then they changed their mind.
Okay, I have, we're past time, so we'll close off now, and if anyone wants to further discuss it, we can.